Hello and welcome to the Critical Eye Asia podcast, inspiring leaders to succeed. I'm Charlie Wagstaff, your host, co-founder and MD here at Critical Eye. These podcasts are part review, part intellectual exploration, drawing on direct experience, engaging on subjects at the forefront of business leaders' minds. Always topical, thought-provoking, enabling you to learn from leaders at the top of their game who have and continue to deliver amazing results. Today, we're going to explore the fascinating and so I think challenging subject of managing cultural difference across the region, a very nuanced subject. But before we start this subject, let's start with our introductions. So delighted to have Hai Meng Tan and Sian Abel. And I'm going to get them to each introduce themselves, and then we can start developing our subject with you. Hai Meng Tan, would you like to be able to start your intro? That'd be lovely. Thank you very much indeed. A short intro.
Yes, please. And thank you very much for having me on this session, Charlie. My name is Hai Meng. I'm currently the president and CEO of Kemin Asia, which is the agri-foods arms of Kemin Industries, headquartered in Des Moines, Iowa. We provide nutritional solutions to customers who make animal feed and are growers of food animals, such as the chicken and pigs that we eat or the milk that we consume in our diet. As part of the operation, I look after 15 markets here in Asia Pacific, comprising Japan, Taiwan, and Korea in North Asia, the 10 markets of ASEAN, and then the two Pacific Island markets of Australia and New Zealand. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Hai Meng, and lovely to have you here today. Sian, can I ask you to do the same, please?
Sure. Thanks, Charlie. And it's nice to meet you, Hai Meng. So my name is Sian Abel. I am currently in the role of global HR business partner. I'm the head of business partnering here at Kyowa Kirin. Kyowa Kirin is a Japanese headquartered pharmaceutical company. We operate with a global footprint and we work or we are structured four regions. So essentially, we have the North American region, which comprises what you would expect. We have the European and rest of world region, which incorporates some distributor markets. We have APAC, which is headquartered out of Singapore. And then we have Japan, which of course is our biggest market and our headquarters, which is where I am very lucky to be based. Recently moved to Tokyo within the last few months and previously have been based and worked across many different markets, but lived always in the Europe area. So happy to be here. Thank you, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
No, oh, thank you, Sian. And I hope I know your move has gone very, very well. But I suppose it must have been a fascinating move for you to undertake and very pertinent, I'm sure, to this subject. Because in many cases, you've been involved in overseeing, managing, observing, coming through cultural dimensions. And now you're very much living and breathing it yourself. So let's start on the subject of managing different cultural dynamics as a regional leader in APAC, or in actual fact across the globe. Obviously bring those elements in as well. Sam, would you like to be able to start just as a regional leader? Now obviously you're stepping up into this role. What sort of skill sets have you observed in others, and are you now perhaps calling upon yourself to be able to be effective? And how does it feel, would you say?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that we probably could talk about for days, actually, Charlie, and especially over a glass of wine or a beer. However, I have worked in Europe. I mean, if you think about the European markets, we think about Europe as being a very diverse, lots of different cultures, languages, currencies, etc. And when we think about Europe, I think there's 300 or so languages. When you look at Asia, I mean, you're looking at, I think it's more than 2,000 languages across the Asian kind of region. I recently moved to Japan, arguably, and you can correct me, of course, if I'm wrong, arguably quite an interesting and relatively insular economy and country. Not particularly well known culturally outside of this region. I think a lot of people know about Japan, of course. I mean, they're wonderful at exporting their innovation and their different ways of working. But I think living here is a really interesting challenge. So incredibly different from the Western European environments I've worked in, or even in the US. The language makes it interesting. The culture, the way people behave makes it interesting. The way that they talk. And I don't just mean the language, of course, Japanese is a very difficult language. I'm doing my best to learn. But I mean, even the structure, the way they use emotion, the way they express themselves is incredibly different from anything I've ever known. So you ask how it feels, Charlie. It's delightful. In many ways, it's wonderful to learn. But I would also say that I have to be very patient with others and with myself. And I have to listen. And I think assume positive intent. So I always believe that people have positive intentions. No one is deliberately trying to trip me up or make me feel silly. Of course not. And all of those things mean that I have to be incredibly patient and I have to listen and seek to understand before I jump to a conclusion or before I judge or before I try and make sense of a situation. Because many of the situations I find myself in, again, I can tell you about some of those over a glass of beer or wine. Many of the situations I find myself in, I choose to find the humor instead of being embarrassed.
Thank you very much indeed for sharing your observations. Haiming, on reflecting on what Sian has just said, what would you like to add or contribute to that introduction to, you know, the skill sets that one needs to have in order to be effective across cultural dimensions?
Well, I cannot help but smile to myself as I listen to Sian mention, you know, her initial forays into into a different culture and a Japanese one at that. And the main reason really is that I've started learning the Japanese language myself, you know, for the last possibly couple of years. And I have to say that being a Singaporean Chinese, you know, I would have thought that it would not be too difficult, but the truth cannot be further than that. And I just want to highlight an example. The word weight in Japanese, apart from meaning weight as we know it in the English language, is also used sometimes by the Japanese to indicate that they are not picking up on your invitation. So let's take, for example, that, you know, at the end of a day, I say, oh, come, let's all go for a drink at the bar. And the person might just say, wait. And he just sort of left it hanging in the air. Basically, he's telling me, I'm sorry, but I'm not coming with you. You know, so that is sort of a little bit of a, you know, a fun fact there. I just feel that, you know, the language piece is really important. And I think apart from language, there's a combination of other skills, qualities and knowledge that are required to help me navigate the diverse cultures that Sian mentioned about in Asia, as well as a very dynamic and complex region. Because apart from the language, there's also that cross-cultural communication. So what applies in one market and in one culture may actually mean quite a different thing in a different culture, in a different context. And so I think those are skills that we need. Those are understanding that we need. And I'm just thinking about my own experience here. It's not just about being sensitive and aware of cultural innuendos, about traditions. Just take, for example, we are now celebrating what is called the Mid-Autumn Festival. This festival is celebrated in a large way in the Chinese-based societies. And after the Lunar New Year, this is possibly the second most important festival. So whether you're in Taiwan, whether you are in Malaysia and Singapore, and even in Korea, this Mid-Autumn Festival is actually a very important festival. perhaps less so in more cosmopolitan society like Singapore, but the more traditional customers still value you bringing sort of mooncakes as sort of a mark of respect and a greeting when you go to visit them during this period. And then I'm also thinking of the quality of being adaptable and flexible, because, the whole region is sort of fairly dynamic, and one needs to be adaptable and flexible to sort of navigate some of the challenges posed by the cultural as well as the operating environment here. Last but not least, like what Xian said, I think we need to be resilient as well as patient. Patience is a virtue seen in this part of the world in particular. Like the Japanese, like what Xian mentioned, as well as in sort of the other societies. I would say that in Asia Pacific, as much importance and as much time should be spent on building relationship with the customer, with the other party. Because only when you do that, then will it ease and grease the transaction later or the resolution of any issue later. And so those are some of my learnings over the years as I sort of operate in this region, Charlie.
Oh, thank you both very, very much indeed. And I suppose let's dig a little bit deeper into that subject, which you started to do, Haiming, in terms of how your insights as leaders have and your perspectives, how they have evolved, and also what you perhaps as a result doing differently. And I imagine COVID might have heightened some of those observations, actually. And so perhaps we should think, mindful of the past, what we're doing differently now and what we think might be important for the future for anyone listening to this about how to transcend and deal with cultural dynamics, and particularly in the backdrop against which we're operating, which is extremely demanding, where things are required tomorrow. And all the things we've spoken about, listening, patience, adaptable and flexibility, might not be something that we've got or we feel that we can respond to. So it's about speed. Haiming, would you like to just build on that a little bit more in terms of how you responded in that environment?
Right. I would say firstly, I just being sort of culturally more aware of the sort of different communication styles among the different cultures has actually helped me to understand my customer pain points better. Because a lot of their buying decisions may not be so evident at first. Yep. You know, what they consider, and they may not articulate so early in the relationship. Different cultures emphasize different things. So I sort of thinking of, let's say, the markets of Australia and New Zealand, they're a lot more direct. They tell you what they don't like. There's a lot more candor in the kind of relationship. In the North Asia and a lot in the Southeast Asian markets, for example, one has to build consensus. Face is very important. And so some of those things I've sort of learned to appreciate. And I've also learned to sort of think in terms of achieving win-win outcomes rather than a simple sort of win-lose scenario. And, and a lot of my customers actually like that. A lot of them put emphasis on, for example, building trust first, as I mentioned earlier, rather than just selling a business deal, you know. And everywhere is the same. Once you seal the deal, nothing beats having a drink. Like what Xian say is over a beer or a wine. And in Japan, we'll probably say over a sake. You know, and customers have actually brought me also into karaoke bars, and we have sung ourselves silly and sort of just let our head down, and so those are just fun, fun to have while sort of slogging away at sort of crafting a business relationship. So I think that a lot of my perception and preconceived ideas, operating on a regional basis has changed over time. And a lot of my customers have actually now become, in many sense of the word, my close friends. Mm. Just this week, a customer of mine from Indonesia called me up and told me, said, look, Haiming, do you have a recommendation for me? I've got this medical condition. Look, I'm not a medical doctor, but I was able to sort of just recommend him to a specialist that I myself have used, and I strongly recommend it to him. A few days later, he called me up from the hospital bed, and he said, "Look, Haiming, I'm just so thankful that you gave me this, you know, this lead. It was more serious than I thought, and the doctor is very good. He's gone up and cleaned up everything, you know." So, you know, it has gone beyond just sort of leading a team, sort of just trying to get business, to sort of forging a relationship. And those are some of the things that I really enjoy being in this role of mine. And I think these are some things that I think are important to becoming an effective leader in this region, Charlie.
Lovely. Thank you very much indeed for those anecdotes and insights. Sian, you will have, in your role as HR practitioner, not only as a leader had to respond to these challenges, but also looked at the capabilities across teams, as I'm sure, and I know that Haiming will as well. But it's about moving people into areas where they can be culturally sensitive. We all have certain perceptions of how people are going to be in certain markets, and we have to challenge those perceptions. Can you just give us some thoughts on that and the challenge that it brings to a business which is regional or global?
Yeah. So I think Haiming said it really well, actually, on trust. I think relationships and trust, particularly in this region, are critical. One of the things that as a kind of Western European person, telling a story and making sure that people connect and that they trust that you have a good intention is so critical, I'm finding, in this region particularly. I also love karaoke, Haiming. So yes, I've partaken in karaoke quite a bit since I've been here. And I have to say, on a serious note, doing social activities, building those relationships, seeking out colleagues, asking about their families, asking about things that are not always work related, has really enabled me to establish those trusting foundations of those relationships. In the West, we start in a different way. Yeah. We start out by telling people what we want them to do. So, you know, we have our five priorities or something, and you communicate those. You say, this is what the company is doing. This is what we stand for. And you expect people to move. And actually, my understanding now of working with my Asian colleagues across multiple markets is we need to tell a story and get trust first. They need to believe in the people. They need to trust the people leading the company. And that's really, really critical. And even more so since COVID, Charlie, you actually made a really good point, because, of course, now, although we're very connected, I mean, look at us today on this call, on this meeting, we're very connected globally, but nothing is really a substitute for sitting down. So building that trust, especially in this, and I'm not going to say post-COVID world, but in this COVID world that we live in, it's so critical. It's so critical, and it's taking longer because sometimes we cannot physically be with one another. So it does take longer. So that patience, that resilience, you need to really think about that now. Whereas before, when we were all physically with one another, it probably came a little bit more easily or a bit faster. It isn't the case now. And I think it is taking longer. So we're more connected, but in a different way, perhaps not so emotionally connected. Perhaps we don't feel that sense of psychological safety or trust as quickly as we might have had we all been physically connected.
Interesting. We've talked largely about, and I suppose you've just flagged it a little bit, about things that don't work as well. We talk quite a lot about the things and why it is important. Any examples from either of you of things that haven't worked and why afterwards you realised that it could have been dealt with in a different way?
I think probably a very, very real example that we're living through now is bringing our teams back into the offices across our global organisation. So in some of our locations, and if I think about Asia particularly, in some of our locations, no problem. Absolutely no problem. People want to be back in the office. Our Tokyo head office, particularly here, people want to be here, Charlie. So you see a lot more people. However, of certain generations. So what I'm seeing is that there are certain age groups and demographic of certain people who are very happy, very excited to be in the office, and certain people who perhaps are struggling. They don't necessarily feel as connected to their colleagues in the office. They don't, you know, necessarily understand why they need to be in the office. They feel very productive at home. So one of the things I think we could have approached differently is engaging all of those generations, all of the population, and explaining the reason why it's important for us to connect physically with one another in an office environment. You know, what is the purpose of the office? And by kind of reframing the purpose of the office as a place for connection or a place for socializing, all of the lovely things that Haimeng said, we need to reframe it. And I don't know if we've done a great job of that yet, to be honest, because we're still seeing a difference in people connecting and really wanting to be here physically. Not that they're not working, they're just working in a very different way.
Interesting. And just coming back to that, I'll bring you in, Haimeng, in a moment. That subject, what you're talking about is being a generation thing, not a cultural thing. So wherever across Asia you find yourself, it is pretty consistent in terms of the challenge or the opportunity. So I think what you're saying is more of a generation thing. Haimeng, would you like to have, is that a similar observation from your perspective?
Yeah, I was going to jump in and ask, I wonder what part of the generation I'm in, because, you know, I do enjoy sometimes working remotely. Other times I really want to come back to work, you know, in the office. And perhaps it is a reflection of my personality, because like what Xian said, I really need to see a physical warm body apart from just looking at them on the, you know, in the screen. And I just want to say that, like you mentioned, Charlie, the COVID has actually upended a lot of things, a lot of our biasness, and it's also caused me to question a lot of my previous decisions that I've made. And so right now, I'm considering a lot more flexible work arrangements, because I think it is important for us to accommodate the different cultural norms as well as personal needs. Because a staff that is maybe just a young parent will have very different needs from one that is possibly of children that are grown up, of flying the nest, you know, leaving the nest. And so those are some things that may influence the way they view each other about coming back to work in the office. And like what Xian said, I think we really need to create an environment where we foster the understanding of each other's needs, that we actually look at each other and say, well, I understand that you are in that phase of your life, that you maybe need to have more time with your children. You want to pick up your children. And so we need to have that flexibility to say, maybe you can report to the office about an hour later, or we schedule our in-person meetings, maybe just closer to lunchtime or something like that. And it's really calling for a lot more understanding amongst the team members. So with respect to flexible hours, respect to remote work options, as well as even compressed work weeks. So in our company, what we do is that we do allow staff to work remotely a couple of days a week, and they can choose the day that they prefer to work remotely. However, we do have what we call the all-in work days, where meetings, where physical presence are needed to be you know, where everybody has to be around. And it need not be for everybody. It could be just for that department or for that functional group or for that team. And so that, you know, we try and encourage this sort of flexible work arrangements. And I think that has helped even in our staff retention. And I just wanted to share an example, because when we brought staff back from working from home to working in the office, I was quite influenced by an article piece that I read a couple of years back, that we need to build a ritual about bringing people back to the office to create a certain, you know, memory and experience for them. So what we did was to, you know, order in quite expensive bento lunches and have all the managers of staff going around welcoming their staff back, you know, and just giving them a bento box and all the sort of good things, you know, and patting on each other and just allowing them time to just sort of revisit each other, to sort of rekindle that water cooler kind of culture, as it were. And that has helped us to sort of ease in into sort of coming back to the office. That was my experience that I wanted to share.
I think that's wonderful. And I think that really adds to that culture in the office, Haimeng. So I think that's a really nice way of approaching it. I think one of the challenges that we see, Charlie, is that in our global headquarter here in Tokyo, although many of our roles are regional, so you have people who are managing regions which have not a huge time zone difference, you know, maybe a few hours or so. We also have a number of global roles, for example, like mine, where I'm supposed to be at least trying to manage the different time zones, which creates a very unique challenge. And it does mean that we have to be quite creative with some of the things that Haimeng says. So, for example, you know, if I'm on calls till 1 or 2 in the morning, of course, I'm not going to be in the office the next day at 9 or 10. You know, I need to be very flexible. We need to accept that if people are trying to work across the North American time zone or trying to connect globally with their colleagues, then sometimes we do need to think about these things. And from a cultural perspective, what I do see is that unfortunately, some of our markets suffer more than others. And what I mean by that is Europe is actually a very friendly time zone. If you think about Asia on one side, North America on the other, you can mostly, within your working day in Europe, capture the time zones. Apart from if you go South Australia, of course, is a law unto itself in a wonderful way. But if you're based in Asia, for example, Japan, where I am, and I'm trying to work across those different time zones, it does create a very interesting dynamic. And it does mean that you have people routinely, like me, like many of my colleagues, working evenings or incredibly early mornings, trying to manage all the things that Haimeng said, family life, social life, well-being, around all of those different time zones. So I don't have the answer, Charlie. I'd love to hear. If you've got the answer, please tell me. And anyone who watches this podcast, I'd love to learn and listen. I don't think we have the answer yet as to the best way to manage it, but I know that it's a big challenge for all of us.
No, well, it leads us very neatly onto the part two of our podcast, which is looking at how one gets HQ to understand the dynamics that we see operating across these regions and globally. So it's a very nice intro into that. Haimeng, I mean, obviously your parent, if one might call them that, is based in the US, I'm correct, am I?
Yes, that's correct, yes.
And so therefore it's about what is their perception of what you are delivering? How do they understand what it is that you are there to achieve? How do you get them to appreciate some of the cultural nuances that we've just discussed in the first part of our podcast? Would you like to be able to give us an overview? And I know, Xian, you will have a perspective, and you've now taken yourself into the HQ because of and some of the challenges that you might observe when you were sitting in Europe would be really, really insightful. But Haimeng, if you'd like to be able to start.
Well, I work for a company that is headquartered, as I said, in Des Moines, Iowa, which is right in the Midwest, the Corn Belt of the U.S. So you can imagine that the culture in the company is one that values hard work, almost Calvinistic in nature, if I may say so. But having said that, hard work in Asia is not necessarily an alien concept. Yep. But having said that, I think there are some quite fundamental differences in the way we approach hard work. So let's take, for example, in Asia, we tend to be what we call a collectivist approach, which is emphasizing on group harmony, emphasizing on cohesion. The Midwesterners and perhaps in Europeans as well in general would be sort of be classified as more individualist, where they emphasize on personal goals and autonomy. And so between the two, I would have to sort of navigate and sort of try to bring these differences, you know, the end goal being the same, that we need to achieve those numbers. But the approach might be quite subtle differences. So, for example, in a collectivist culture, they may sort of prioritize teamwork and consensus building. which can be quite alien to the Westerner and the Midwestern American in particular, because they value individual achievement, you see. And so those are some of the things that, you know, there's a certain amount, I thought, a bit of an education, as it were, of the head office in that sense. Secondly, I think that there is some positive things that we can learn from the West that I need to bring down to the Asian in particular. And that is the work-life balance or work-life autonomy. Because Asians can work so hard that they forget about their own personal well-being. I used to have a running joke to my staff. I say that, you know, just look at me. I really have the perfect work-life balance. And they all look at me with, you know, disbelief. And they say, how do you do that? I say, well, you see, I do all the work and my wife, Selena, has all the life. So we do have the perfect work-life balance. Now, that's a joke, of course. But, but I think that because the Midwesterners also value individual time, downtime, pursuit of hobbies and interests, this is something that I also try to introduce to the team here. I said, look, you don't have to be a clock watcher. We don't value clock watching, as it were. We value output. So that, I think it can be a balance of both sort of strengths from both sides, both cultures. And I think this is the advantage, apart from the challenge that you mentioned, Charlie.
Well, one of the, and it'd be interesting also, we can develop about whether we think this has evolved over time and whether it's more homogenous than it used to be before. But there are some systems that might be perceived as Western in terms of like an appraisal system and about you differentiating and calling people out.
Yes.
That would be foreign to how one needs to lead in Asia. If how's one managed that when that HQ was saying you must do those, you must have those systems, you must have a meritocracy, you must differentiate, you must call people out. When that's something that would be alien to what you might need and feel is necessary?
I'm not sure why I can answer that adequately, but I just want to share that there was a management tip that I learned from a late CEO of mine many years ago. And yeah, he taught me this, and to this day, I try to practice it. Not a very good student, I must add. He said that when you praise a staff, do that in public. Do that in public. But when you have to correct somebody, do that in private. Especially in Asian context, he said that's very important. And this advice was given to me by an Australian, by the way. So,
but it summarizes the response beautifully. So thank you very much indeed for that. Sian, your observations.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I try and focus on, of course, and you'll see behind me here, and you've mentioned teamwork, or WA, as we say, which is the balance of team, the balance of people. When we look at the Japanese culture particularly, we do have a common language, and it's not a spoken language in that way, but it's our culture and our values, Charlie. So to your point around how do we connect, how do we kind of work across the different cultures, is that we have a common understanding of what is expected of us at work, what is encouraged, and what should we celebrate? And it's our values, basically. It's our culture and our values. So even if you come from a different part of the world, even if you work in a different way, we actually do have a common language that connects all of us, which is our culture and our values. I do want to say what Haimeng said around reward in public and perhaps, correct in private. That is absolutely how I try to operate as well. The additional piece I would say is, in my experience so far, the feedback culture, particularly in Japan and in Asia, is perhaps not as well established or as well understood by leaders and managers as it might be in kind of North America or in the West. So one of the things that I have to do is I'm trying to encourage people to recognize each other, Jaime. So I'm trying to get my team to really think, you know, let's celebrate wins. Let's celebrate when someone demonstrates something in a wonderful way, and we want to bring it to life, and we want to other people to recognize it. So I'm trying to do more of those things. And it's not necessarily Western. It's just in line with our culture and values. You know, it's trying to bring that out to the forefront. And it's easier for me as a Westerner, if I'm honest, because I'm seen as someone who's a little bit different anyway. So when I'm actually bringing a different idea or a different way of working, people are like, oh, okay, what's she saying? I don't have to abide by the same social norms or rules as everyone else. So it's actually easier for me sometimes to bring innovation or to bring a different idea. And I have to say, I use that to my advantage from time to time, Jaime. It doesn't always work. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I can use it to my advantage from time to time.
Got you. You're used for having that element of approach, aren't you? You're excused for being who you are, which comes with this cultural acceptance of individuals. But just developing that a little bit further, often high levels of performance in an individual or a team is used as a point of reference to lift other people up, is I think in essence what you're talking about. And that's and it's doing it in a relatively public way, and it's a public way that has got to be carefully balanced. How does one achieve that when you're trying to get people to a place, when you're trying to respond to change, when you're trying to improve, and you see excellence and you say, I want to shine a light on that excellence. I'm very interested, Hamang, in terms of your perspective of that and that opportunity it might present.
Yeah. Well, I'm currently sort of struggling, I'm trying to confront this issue of how do you improve or encourage your staff to sort of be better.
Yes.
And we are now on this journey, what I call cultivating a growth mindset. And what I've learned is that a growth mindset can be very loosely defined as having the mindset that you want to be better today than you were yesterday. You don't have to be perfect, just be better today than you were yesterday. And to understand what are some of the roadblocks, some of the trigger factors that might have prevented you from being better today than yesterday. And so being self-aware is something that I'm sort of trying to encourage in my team and I. And once we do that, I think, you know, we sort of move away from having to shine a spotlight on anybody in particular. But really, it becomes like, it's like a golfer's short game. You're playing against yourself. You know, you may be sort of a 10 under over par yesterday, but if today you were 5 over par, then you have improved. And that would be the kind of growth mindset we're trying to encourage.
Okay, and I, in trying to encourage that, is it something that's done in a very, can you do it in a direct way amongst the group? Or is it something that has to be done more subtly in terms of lobbying? I'm interested just to know how one gets people there.
For me and my leadership team, at least, we think that it has to do with culture. Yes. And part of the culture has to do with the language, and so we are trying to infuse in a company here the language that are associated with a growth mindset. So, if for example somebody would say, you know, we've tried that before, it doesn't work, and then we will all raise our hand and say, let's have a growth mindset. How about that?
So you've identified a way to be able to challenge it within a group context. How fascinating. Okay, good. Final point, just to wrap up on, is our senior leaders, our board, our exco, how can they best deliver what's required across the globe through yourselves as senior leaders? And what challenges would you have need to be overcome to be able to convince them of what's going on locally? And so this global versus local, which is always an interesting transaction that takes place, and there's potentially friction. Any advice you'd give to people about how best to manage that? Haimeng.
Okay, so I want to sort of go back to a point which I think Xian mentioned, and I just want to build on that. And I think that for me, I think it is important to perhaps have some global meetings that is held in the region. So get them, you know, off their favorite seat in their favorite location and come into Asia and be challenged by the dietary, sort of offerings here, challenged by the weather, you know, and some of the mayhem in the street, you know, things like that. But it is one part of it. The other part is to really encourage the board, the corporate board, to appoint a member to be appointed as a champion or a sponsor of a development or initiative in this region. Because invariably, that helps to bridge the cultural gap between the two groups of personalities. And I think that I see myself as an evangelist of sort, which is to go back to the HQ and keep drumming this message that the more cultural enlightened a company board and the senior leadership is, the more successful the company can be in terms of taking advantage of the opportunities that present themselves in the region while avoiding unnecessary conflict. And it will also help the company to be more adaptable to regional challenges and help them to stay more nimble and just ride on the growth of Asia Pacific in general.
Lovely. Xian.
Yeah, I would say all of what Haimeng said, I was nodding along furiously because I think he's on the money. But I would also say data. You know, when people aren't as familiar with certain regions or certain ways of working, it's important to share some of that data. And it's important to kind of highlight where that data plays a role, what we can gain from that, what story do we tell? So that would be my addition. I also just want to make one mention. One of the things that we have done, and we're still evolving our way of kind of recognizing people, but we actually created team awards, Charlie, around some of the things that we wanted to incentivize and recognize and kind of drive as a company. And they are team awards for cross-functional best practice, focus on the patient, you know, all of these wonderful things that we really would like as a company. And they are global awards, which means we get nominations from all over the world. And it's really remarkable how many people vote. These are open to everybody globally. And it's really remarkable how many people vote and get involved in these things. So when we can showcase, to your point, some of those best practices and recognize, reward, incentivize, it really does do wonders. And we haven't done it perfectly. It's still evolving. But I do think it's a wonderful way of doing it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both very much indeed. Finally, anything else you'd like to add?
No, I did enjoy myself. I'm sure I speak for Xian as well, even though, you know, and Charlie, you did a good job of sort of poking us at the right places. And so, you know, we just cover what we think is some of the fun that we have working in this region.
Yeah, absolutely. Well and said, Jaime.
And I hope also you'll continue the dialogue. But thank you both so very much. We thoroughly enjoyed it.